From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, another week of asking why, this time in the case of Breonna Taylor.
My mom sees me in these women. I see myself in these women, and I just don't want to become a hashtag or a t-shirt. I don't.
The future of the U.S. Supreme Court with the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
It is the rare prophet who not only imagines a new world, but also makes that new world a reality in her lifetime.
And checking in on the well-being of healthcare workers as the U.S. marks 200,000 deaths from COVID-19.
The virus is not going anywhere, and as much as we want it to, it is not slowing down.
All ahead on Perspective. The fight for social justice once again erupting in the nation's cities, from New York to St. Louis to Portland to the nation's capital. People took to the streets. But the marches began in Louisville, Kentucky, where back in March, a 26-year-old paramedic named Breonna Taylor was shot and killed by three police officers in her own apartment. The protests followed a grand jury decision in the case. ABC's Jim Ryan is there.
Police Officer Brent Hankison, Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly, and Detective Miles Cosgrove were serving a drug-related search warrant that night. They insist they identified themselves as they entered Breonna Taylor's apartment. Her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, says they did not, and he opened fire on them. Taylor was killed by police gunfire, but the grand jury found that
Mattingly and Cosgrove were justified in their use of force after having been fired upon by Kenneth Walker.
Attorney General Daniel Cameron says Hankison is to be charged with endangering the lives of Taylor's neighbors because some of his bullets went through the wall. Hours after the grand jury's decision was announced, protests, which had been a daily occurrence since March, began to grow. As a police SWAT team was working crowd control in the evening, a man opened fire, wounding two officers. Both are expected to recover, and a suspect was quickly taken into custody. But during a night of disturbances, 127 people were arrested. Benjamin Crump, the attorney for Breonna Taylor's family, appealed for calm.
Breonna Taylor would not have condoned any violence whatsoever. And so let's respect the legacy of Breonna Taylor, because obviously it wasn't respected in that grand jury proceeding.
The next day, the mayor of Louisville took steps to stop the violence.
This is the Louisville Metro Police Department. The time is 9:00. The curfew order is in effect. Violation of the curfew.
And it appeared to work. 24 people were taken into custody, less than a fifth as many as the night before, mostly for ignoring the curfew, but some for property damage. Now the FBI is conducting a separate probe into Breonna Taylor's shooting, and the entire episode has Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear urging the Attorney General to make public the evidence he presented to the grand jury.
I believe that the Attorney General can release the information from his criminal investigation without impacting the federal civil rights investigation.
He wants to give the public some insight into why no murder charges were filed against the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's killing. Jim Ryan, ABC News, Louisville.
Breonna Taylor was also at the center of a movement in American pro sports. And in the wake of her death, many high-profile athletes said they weren't surprised, but were hurt and disappointed by the decision. Jaylen Brown of the Boston Celtics.
Until we dismantle, recreate, or, you know, change this system that we have, it's going to continue to have victims, you know, like Breonna Taylor and others.
Denver Nuggets head coach Michael Malone.
When I think of that case and the tragedy of, of those police officers getting off, it also makes me think a lot closer to home and Elijah McClain, and how we're still demanding justice for the police officers in Aurora.
And LeBron James, who's spoken out numerous times about Breonna Taylor's death, took to the court on Thursday night for the first time after the grand jury decision.
Just look at the history of, you know, of America, and the disrespect that black women has gotten all for the last 400 years. I mean, you can't turn a blind eye to that.
Inside the WNBA's Florida bubble, Taylor's name has been on the backs of players' jerseys all season. MVP Asia Wilson is a member of the league's Social Justice Council. She had an emotional exchange while taking a question from 9-year-old journalist Pepper Pursley, who writes and does podcasts for The Next website.
I just wanted to tell you that I'm one of those little black girls looking up to you. The news of no arrests of the cops who killed Breonna Taylor is really hard for little black girls like me to hear. So what message would you give to kids like me who are confused and sad and angry?
Ooh, Pepper, you got me tearing up. My message is to keep fighting. We cannot stop fighting at all for young girls like Pepper, for young girls like myself. This fight does not end. It gets harder as you get older, Pepper. I hate that you even have to think about going through it. But it's people like me, it's the generation and in myself that's gonna help fight this fight alongside you. And I hate that you have to fight it at such a young age, but this is the world that we live in. I'm gonna make sure that you don't ever have to live through this as hard as we've lived through it right now. When you get older, I hope that there's a change, that you don't have to continue to write about it, to be an awesome journalist that you are, but we need a lot more people like you in the world, Pepper. And my thing is just to dream big and don't let anyone tell you that you cannot do something, that you are incapable, unqualified to do something just because of the color of your skin. Just keep the fight and you're not in it alone.
So what happens now? As the marches and protests continue, many are asking, where do we go next in the quest for lasting change? ABC News has been asking if our country really has reached a turning point when it comes to social justice. We have talked about reparations for the descendants of slaves and Native Americans, how urban renewal has sometimes decimated black communities, even how the pandemic has changed the relationship that many black women have with their hair. One of the architects of the Turning Point series here at ABC is Nightline producer Candace Smith, who we talked to after the Breonna Taylor decision was handed down.
You know, I think what a lot of people, they are both deeply disappointed and also not surprised. So I think a lot of people are feeling that they saw what they expected to happen, that someone would be prosecuted for killing a young woman in their home, did not happen.
And it's something that also came not just with Breonna Taylor, but really the spark came right during the middle of the pandemic and George Floyd. Is that what led to, this entire Turning Point project?
Yeah, I think that we realized that after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor's name really began circulating in the pandemic, once we realized, again, a confirmation of sort of what we intrinsically knew, that this is going to affect people of color differently and more devastatingly. What we've really been trying to do is look at how do we dig into these issues in a really targeted and concerted way. And what we came up with is a month-long programming event where we almost exclusively focus on issues pertaining to people of color, pertaining to race and identity, and this moment of reckoning that we're in.
Were there any of these stories that really stood out to you as being, you know, particularly meaningful?
So our What America Owes series focuses on reparations. And we're looking at that to start with three different ethnic groups, descendants of the enslaved, Native Americans, and Mexican Americans. Because what we really sought out to do was look not just in this moment, but look at the historical context that led to this moment and what we know from reading history. But I think what we realize is what a lot of people don't know is how systematic the efforts were to disenfranchise people of color, you know, throughout our history, right? When you look at the history of Native Americans in this country, we all sort of know how they were here first and they got pushed out of their land. When it comes to descendants of the enslaved, we know this was the people that was brought here against their will. And then, you know, for generations and generations to come, disenfranchised. And then when it came to Mexican Americans, this was, I think for a lot of people, perhaps a part of our history that's less well known, but also I think just as shocking. And so we really just wanted to dig in. So for when people ask the question, why does anyone need reparations? That was so many years ago. What we're really trying to do is look at the start of this country's history and look at how that continues to this very day. In some ways, it makes you a little sad and it makes you a little hopeless to see that this is stuff that is so deeply ingrained in our country. But then I think the platform that we as news outlets have to really dig in and allow people to tell their stories, you know, after our episode on Native Americans, our producer Tenzin Shakya had been in contact with many tribal leaders, and so many of them got back to her saying, thank you for telling our stories. And for us, that is the gratifying part. And I think where media has power, that's our power, to be able to allow other people to tell stories that are not often told.
Where can people see these now?
So we have a special place on Hulu. If you go to Hulu's top picks and search Turning Point, we're there. You can also look at abcnews.com. If you go to our Nightline page, they're there. And then across the network, there is a landing page for the Turning Point series that highlights all the work that all these great platforms are doing.
Candace, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
In the Breonna Taylor case, attorney Benjamin Crump says he will continue pushing for justice for her and for other black men and women killed by police under suspicious circumstances. He spoke on Friday.
I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So we are here declaring in Breonna Taylor's name, enough is enough, America. Enough is enough, America. Enough is enough, America. Enough.
And then Breonna Taylor's aunt, Bianca Austin, read a letter from Breonna's mother, Tamika Palmer.
I was reassured Wednesday of why I have no faith in the legal system, in the police, in the law that are not made to protect us black and brown people. But when I speak on it, I'm considered an angry black woman. But know this, I am an angry black woman.
That's right.
I am not angry for the reasons that you would like me to be.
That's right.
I'm sorry. But angry because our black women keep dying at the hands of police
black
officers.
Men. Black men.
And black men. Okay. Angry because our children are dying at the hands of police officers. And I'm angry because this nation is learning that our black women dying at the hands of police officers, and this is not okay.
That's not what I write.
You can take the dog out of the fight, but you can't take the fight out of the dog.
Say it again.
For lack of better terms, bark, bark for being the dog still standing to fight. You didn't just rob me of my and my family. You robbed the world of a queen. A queen willing to do a job that most of us could never stomach to do. A queen willing to build up anyone around her. A queen who was starting to pave her path. I hope you never have to know the pain of knowing your child is in need and help and you're not able to give them. I hope you never hear the sounds of seeing someone cry and beg for your child to get help and she never receives help. Those cries was ignored. I hope you never know the pain of your child being murdered 191 days in a row. Tamika Palmer.
Jesus.
As if 2020 couldn't get any more dramatic, all of us this week have been grappling with the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The tributes in Washington were many. Her flag-draped casket carried up the steps of the Supreme Court by black mask-wearing pallbearers. Inside the Great Hall, a private service where Chief Justice John Roberts called her a star on the bench.
Her 483 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions will steer the court for decades. They are written with the unaffected grace of precision.
And her rabbi, Lauren Holtzblatt, called her a prophet.
To be able to see beyond the world you are in, to imagine that something can be different. That is the job of a prophet. And it is the rare prophet who not only imagines a new world, but also makes that new world a reality in her lifetime.
On Thursday, when President Trump came to pay his respects, chants of vote him out and honor her wish broke out among the crowd waiting in line, in reference to Ginsburg's dying wish, according to her granddaughter, that her replacement on the court not be named until after the presidential election. On Friday, Ruth Bader Ginsburg became the first woman to ever lie in state in the U.S. Capitol, a fitting tribute to the jurist who made fighting for women's rights the centerpiece of her career. The loss of Justice Ginsburg wasn't just felt in Washington, though. ABC's Devin Dwyer traveled this week to Bloomington, Minnesota, to talk about her passing with voters who were already waiting in line to cast ballots.
What did you think Friday night when you heard the news about Ruth Bader
Ginsburg? Oh, I cried.
You cried?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm almost crying now.
She was what?
I'm almost crying now.
Oh.
It was just awful. And then to think people don't understand, too, that these general elections are important for the whole future of our Supreme Court and the decisions that are being made and how this can harm, you know, especially black people, women, Hispanic people. It's just any minority.
Why did she touch you so much? I mean, she was...
Well,
she's kind
I grew
of up,
up
there in an ivory tower far, far away.
Yeah, but
so
you know,
many people like yourself
yeah.
have been so emotional.
So emotional. But I grew up, you know, watching the cases that she had in front of the Supreme Court years and years,
and
decades ago.
Them.
And
yeah.
she argued them, and she argued against 9 kind of old white males, and she still got her point through. She was just brilliant. And she knew how to talk about Roe v. Wade as a privacy issue and a public health issue.
She led in many ways, and you know, in her early cases, she really fought for women's rights, and I think she did a lot as a Supreme Court justice. And she was a little to the left of center, but she could come to the center when it made sense legally. And I think she looked at the facts. That's what the problem right now is, I think, is that people don't look at the facts always when they're making decisions. So, yeah, I thought she was a fantastic justice.
This weekend, the argument over Ginsburg's replacement kicks into high gear. The Republicans have enough votes to confirm the next justice, who President Trump says he wants seated quickly, just in case the next election is disputed.
I think this will end up in the Supreme Court, and I think it's very important that we have 9 justices.
But ABC News political analyst Matthew Dowd says there are possible pitfalls, depending on the timing.
You're going to have 38 days left until Election Day. So I still think there's a question of whether or not the vote is held before Election Day. Let me give you a scenario. Trump, the president loses badly, and the Republicans lose the Senate. Then I think there's a sense of they're in a different world now. And once they're in that different world, do they still go ahead with it? And I think that's an open question. I think it opens up the possibility a lot more senators say now Mitch McConnell is no longer majority leader. They no longer have the Senate. They lost badly in the election. Should they go forward with this? And so I think it's a big question mark.
Why not wait? That's what he's wondering.
I mean, I don't know the full strategy of this. I mean, to me, politically, strategically, if I were in the middle of this, I would say the best thing for the Republicans in this moment is to have a nominee, start the process, but announce that they're going to hold the vote after Election Day, because what they're doing is they're giving the Democratic base an even deeper reason to come turn out in the election, not only against the president, but against every Republican that holds office that's on the Senate, that's up for the Senate. And so it from a political strategy point of view, I still think there may be people in the caucus that say, hey, you know, we've looked at this, and yes, we think it's a good idea to start the process, but we think voting right before Election Day and forcing this thing through is only going to make the Democratic base angrier and angrier and angrier. As you can see, they're not going to get any extra turnout by having this vote before Election Day. They possibly could get an extra turnout if they postpone it until after Election Day and say, we're going to wait till after Election Day, which then encourages Republicans to vote. So maybe, who knows what's going on behind closed doors, and maybe this is just what they're putting in the thing to draw it back out and say, oh, we're going to be reasonable now and just hold the process and carry the vote. But I mean, I would really be scared if I were a Republican on the ballot being forced to vote on this before Election Day.
This will, of course, be a big topic at Tuesday night's first presidential debate in Cleveland. Something to keep in mind when you watch or listen. Unless a debate is being tabulated with points like in high school or college, there really is no winner or loser, just pundits telling you who they think won or lost and why. Listen to the answers, think about it, and make up your own mind on who you think should lead the country for the next 4 years. The election is now a little over a month away. Coming up, a stunning number of American lives lost to COVID-19. On Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, we'll take it to space with an astronaut who has some tips on surviving isolation. But first, we here in the United States make up right around 5% of the world's population. But Americans make up 20% of the world's nearly 1 million deaths from the coronavirus. 200,000 people in this country have now lost their lives due to complications from COVID-19. ABC's Michelle Franson has more on a tiny fraction of them.
Within those dire figures, there are the faces and stories of the lives lost. Some too soon, including a two-month-old baby in Michigan who died of COVID-19 just this month. Others like Margit Feldman died at the age of 90 from coronavirus after surviving the Holocaust. She moved to the U.S. and spent her life educating younger generations about the Holocaust.
I can't say it is my pleasure, but I will say it is my duty.
Army veteran Larry Rathgab of Michigan died at age 90, serving his country in uniform and also through innovation, being part of General Douglas MacArthur's Motor Pool and Honor Guard, and then NASCAR, going down in racing history as lead engineer for the team that helped build the first race car to reach 200 miles per hour. Corliss Henry was 95 from New Jersey and a pioneer in the healthcare profession. She became the first Black nurse on staff at the Muhlenberg Hospital and later became a teacher. One of her former students,
Mrs. Corliss Henry, was my nursing instructor in the 1960s. Her wealth of knowledge, quiet presence, and fairness were her strengths. She will be missed.
ABC's Aaron Katursky anchored our special coverage this week, marking 200,000 deaths in the U.S. He also talked about the toll all of it has been taking on the nation's doctors, nurses, and caregivers with ABC News chief medical correspondent Dr. Jennifer Ashton.
No matter where they lived, many of the 200,000 dead gen spent the last moments of their lives with a nurse or a doctor or some other healthcare worker. That's a lot for them to bear. How are they doing? And should we be worried about our healthcare workers in this country?
I think we should be worried about our healthcare workers. But by the way, I think we should always be worried about our healthcare workers. Aaron, I just spoke to a nurse in a Connecticut emergency room just last week who was put on COVID duty during the spring when the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, were on fire. And she told me that she was holding iPhones, iPads up to relatives so that they could see or even try to communicate with their loved one right before they died. So will there be PTSD on the part of nurses and anyone who works in a hospital and physicians? Absolutely. And that is a reminder to us that we have to take care of mental health as much as we do physical health, because we won't be able to continue taking care of all of the other run-of-the-mill medical issues that have not stopped, by the way, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, if we don't take care of the mental trauma that this virus is inflicting on our healthcare workers.
When we were at the beginning of this, talking about a cruise ship or a single nursing home in Washington state, could you have imagined that we would be here? I mean, did it have to be this way?
I don't think anyone who's alive today could have imagined this in its magnitude, in its duration, in its impact that crosses lines and boundaries. It literally has infiltrated every sphere of our country, of our day-to-day existence, of the world. No one could have foreseen that. I definitely was one of those people. However, it felt different to me than any other medical story that I've covered over the last 14 years. In terms of whether we could have done anything differently, looking back and learning from our responses and actions and mistakes and what we did well, what we didn't do well, that's part of clinical medicine. We do that regularly. That's the only way we can learn to take care of people better. But also, this story is not going anywhere, and the virus is not going anywhere. And as much as we want it to, it is not slowing down. It's going through its ups and downs, but it is telling us that it's here for the long haul. And so we have to be able to do two things, Aaron, at the same time, and do it quickly and efficiently, which is deal with what's happening today, keep an eye on the horizon of what may be happening tomorrow, while at the same time looking back and figuring out how we could have done things better so that we don't repeat the same mistakes in the future.
ABC's Aaron Katursky with our chief medical correspondent here at ABC News, Dr. Jen Ashton. During the pandemic, there's been an increase in substance abuse. It's also had a significant impact on mental health in communities across the country. ABC News producer Jenny Goldstein has more on some of the steps being taken. And again, as a part of our ABC News Turning Point series, we're focusing on how addiction affects certain disenfranchised communities. Here's Jenny.
September is National Recovery Month, an entire month dedicated to educating Americans about substance use disorders, mental health treatment, and services.
I am a woman in long-term recovery from alcohol and drug addiction.
Patty McCarthy is the CEO of the organization Faces and Voices of Recovery.
I have overcome challenges with my own alcohol and drug use and have now been in recovery for over 30 years.
This year marks the 31st anniversary of National Recovery Month. This year's theme,
Join the Voices for Recovery, Celebrating Connections. Recovery is a journey. We want a path to a better future.
Martine Hackett is an associate professor in the Master of Public Health and Community Health Programs at Hofstra University. She says the first step to recovery is acknowledgement.
You really cannot attempt to solve that problem or to even begin your recovery until you acknowledge that.
Hackett says racial disparities exist in the process of recovery. This is in part due to the barriers that hinder minorities in particular from getting the help they need.
Some of these barriers that minorities face when it comes to identifying help have to do with even their perceived need for treatment, recognizing that they might not want to have help from official means and might be more comfortable seeking help from family or from religious institutions.
Another obstacle,
health insurance coverage or access to behavioral health services.
Trauma and racial stress can make minorities more susceptible to misusing drugs or alcohol as a coping mechanism.
Some of this has to do with concepts around trauma and the experiences of trauma, particularly at an early age. People who are exposed to stressors, there's research that talks about the stressors of racism and how those stressors can cause behaviors that, you know, people reach to be able to deal with those stressors.
Hackett says Native Americans are the most affected by these disparities.
They have a higher rate of addiction, but they also have a lower rate of recovery and being able to seek recovery.
As for National Recovery Month, McCarthy says connecting in 2020 will be a little different than previous years.
We know that we can't do it alone. So that's why the theme of celebrating connections is so important, especially right now during COVID-19, when connecting with people has become a whole new challenge, when we're not able to visit with people in person or attend our usual gatherings to support recovery.
McCarthy also says the language and terminology we use when referring to those in recovery is an important step.
We no longer use words like addict. We no longer use the word drug abuser. We have to remember that these are our family, friends, sons and daughters. We have shifted to person first language, such as a person with a substance use disorder.
Hackett says the stigma can make it more difficult for those struggling to seek help. This is especially true for minorities.
The idea of stigma, that there are certain ways of that different cultures view addiction, and that people might not feel comfortable being able to even admit that they have a problem.
Faces and Voices of Recovery has a website where resources are accessible both during and beyond National Recovery Month.
NationalRecoveryMonth.org. So visit the website. You can find out where the events are that are happening and stay up to date.
As the month of September comes to an end, the fight for recovery and dismantling racial barriers continues. Ending the stigma and making resources available to all is a step in the right direction. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Jenny Goldstein, ABC News.
It has been a heavy year, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to take a little time at the end of this show to look to the future, examine the innovations of space travel, and what it might be like to one day travel to space as a tourist. Retired Colonel Terry Virts served in the U.S. Air Force as a fighter pilot and a NASA astronaut. He has piloted the space shuttle, flown a Russian Soyuz spacecraft, performed spacewalks, and commanded the International Space Station. He's also spent 7 months total in space, so he knows a thing or two about isolation. It's pretty safe to say Terry knows a lot about space. He's written about much of it in a new book called How to Astronaut, An Insider's Guide to Leaving Planet Earth. In it, he answers a lot of the questions he's gotten over the years. How does it feel to be weightless? How do you take a shower? How do you eat, sleep? Can you have sex up there? And what happens if you get stranded? We talked about it this week, all of it related to the future of space travel, including some of the quirky things astronauts have to worry about you probably never think of. What I really liked about this book is that it's like a reader for people who have questions about what it's like to be an astronaut, to be up there in space. Have you been asked a lot of these questions before, and that's what made you write the book?
I have. In fact, public speaking is kind of my day job, or it was until the COVID hit. And there's always a million questions. People are fascinated by space. So I wanted to write a book that could bring the details of space to people in a fun way. It's not a technical manual. This is 51 short essays about cool topics and mundane topics about spaceflight.
One of the topics that you have in here is Just Add Water, Space Station Cuisine. And you go off on how much you like it. You liked space food.
You know, I prefer Earth food. There's a lab here at the Johnson Space Center, and it's a group of ladies actually that run the food lab, and it's pretty good food. Now it is, you know, dehydrated and irradiated, and it's kind of like the military food you get. It's called MREs. It was pretty good. I was happy, and eating was always a good part of the day for me.
Another chapter I really liked was No Showers for 200 Days, No Problem, when you talked about how you actually take showers in space.
The problem is water or anything is probably $30,000, $40,000 a kilogram. So a 1 liter bottle of water will cost you tens of thousands of dollars to launch into space. So taking showers is just too expensive. Plus it would be a massive device to suck up all the water and recycle it. And, you know, it's just too much of a pain. So it's cheaper to throw clothes away. It's cheaper to send up a new t-shirt than once a week than it is, you know, bottles of water to wash them.
You also have a chapter on making whoopee in space. talk more about that.
Well, you got to read the chapter to find out. But I think the title of the chapter is It Was a Long 200 Days. So you can imagine what my experience was. But look, where there's a will, there's a way. That's for sure. But, you know, for me, that was more of a funny chapter. So you got to read it.
Now, another thing you talk about, too, is everybody's in these floating sleeping bags covered from head
right
to toe. And you described it sort of as losing all your senses, and you're just floating in this dark bubble. Is that what it's like?
I love sleeping in space. I was worried about it at first. I didn't know if I'd be able to sleep or not because it's such an alien thing. But for me, it worked really well. I did have this weird thing in my brain, and it went on for months, where whenever I closed my eyes, I was pitching forward and rolling left. And then, you know, I'd open my eyes and that sensation would immediately stop because I would figure out that I'm not pitching forward and rolling left. Every night when I went to bed, I'd close my eyes, I'd feel this sensation for a while. But then when I fell asleep, it was gone. It wasn't like in my dreams, I felt like I was tumbling. But the sensation of sleep itself was awesome. I'd put on, we have these Bose headsets, plug it into the laptop and just listen to music. I listened to the Interstellar soundtrack for about a month. The Russians sent up some sounds from Earth, so I listened to rain for about a month. I wasn't Velcroed to the wall or clipped to the ceiling or anything. I would just float And it was awesome.
What about that instant death when you're thinking of that? Like if you're, you know, suddenly you're David Bowie, you know, just floating out there.
Right.
Does that cross your mind?
It does, but you just can't think about it. I think I was a fighter pilot, and I think one of the things that we do well is compartmentalize. If you thought about that for 200 days, you know, you'd go insane. But I'm working on another film project, a documentary, and the director I'm working with wrote a script for me, and he said, you know, this loop of disaster is playing constantly in the back of your brain. You just have to figure out how to put it in a different compartment in your brain so it's not in the front.
That's really interesting, because I think that would help a lot of people during this pandemic. Not only could you help them with that, but you can also help them with the isolation a little bit too.
Back in March and April, I wrote a short book about being stuck in space. We had a couple of cargo ships blow up, and I was stuck in space. We didn't know when we were coming back. We were low on supplies. So it was really similar to what we're doing down here now. I condensed that short book into a chapter. And so there is a chapter in How to Astronaut about how to survive isolation. You know, you got to keep a positive attitude. This is not going to last forever. You got to keep yourself active and get out of the house and get some physical exercise. I think doing something artistic is important. When I was in space, I took pictures and I helped film a movie, A Beautiful Planet, which is really helping me now because I'm kind of moving into the TV and film universe. So I think if you can write a book or learn photography or start painting or whatever, doing something artistic, I think, is really good for the human brain.
One of the last things I'm going to ask you is we have interviewed another astronaut on here before. I can't remember what his last name was. His first name is Clay. He goes by Astro Clay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Clay Anderson.
He said one of the things that was the toughest was if you're up there with somebody you don't particularly like. And maybe people could learn with that a little bit, too.
That is super important. Look, you're not going to like everybody in life. And even if you're married to someone that you love, if you're spending 24/7 for 200 days with them, that's going to get old after a while. Give yourself some personal space and some personal time. The technical aspects of spaceflight are hard and can kill you, but it's the psychological aspect that's even harder, the interpersonal relationships, because that is the ultimate quarantine. It's the ultimate isolation, being stuck in a can with a few other people. Many of them are not even from your country, don't speak your language.
Terry, thank you so much. We appreciate it. It's a great book, and keep on keeping on during the pandemic. Good luck with the TV and film gig.
Thank you.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.